Tonight on The Whistleblowers, The Deep State. So many on the American left call it a right-wing trope. Others say it's the real power in Washington, a permanent power that transcends presidential administrations. I can tell you that the deep state is real. I know because I was a part of it. And today we're exposing it all for the world to see. I'm John Kiriakou, and this is The Whistleblowers. I've long maintained that the deep state is real. You don't have to call it the deep state. You can call it the state. You can call it the federal bureaucracy. Either way, there is no denying that there's a huge cadre of more or less permanent senior level federal employees in places like the CIA, the FBI, NSA, and the Departments of State, Defense, and Justice. It's not unusual for governmental employees in what's called the Senior Executive Service, the Senior Intelligence Service, and the Senior Foreign Service to remain in their jobs for 25, 30, even 35 years. They know that presidents come and go every 4 or 8 years, and control of Congress can change every 2 years. While those changes are happening, these senior service employees remain in their positions, creating policy and essentially running the government. And if they don't like something that a president wants them to do, well, they just ignore him, or they slow roll the request, waiting for him to no longer be in office. Once upon a time, this might have been described as good governance, as a way of maintaining the status quo. But others might call it insubordination, and still others might call it sedition. But again, in everyday life in Washington, D.C., one man's deep state is another man's normal life in the big city. So what makes a deep state so dangerous? We're joined by former CIA analyst and counterterrorism official Larry Johnson. Larry, thanks for joining us. It's good to see you again.
Man, I'm glad you didn't say, and here's the reason it's so dangerous. Mr. Johnson!
Well, you know what? Yeah. Let's start at the very beginning then. There are disagreements over what exactly the deep state is, or even if there is such a thing as the deep state. I think you and I probably agree that there is. Many people use the term loosely. How do you define it, and what key features distinguish it from a normal bureaucracy or a security apparatus?
Yeah, it's career officers that are embedded across the government, top secret clearances primarily. That's where I think the heart of the deep state is, because they get to play the game. If you're not read into those programs, we can't talk to you or talk about it, number one. Number two, the knowledge is power thing really works. You know, I always remember being amused that when I started as an analyst, and I'm sure you experienced the same thing. Here you are with this as the actually substantive expert on, in your case, Iraq, in my case, Honduras. And we're writing out talking points for principals who are going to go to these meetings with the president and pretend that they actually know the substance of it, when more often than not, they're reading off the talking points. So really, you were the power behind the throne. You just didn't know it at the time. And it is those careerists, though, who rise up through the ranks. And, you know how many years it took you to get a knowledge of sort of how the sausage is made at CIA. But you didn't have knowledge of how the sausage was being made at DOD. How the sausage was being made at FBI. I was fortunate because, you know, I did my first year as a career trainee. I got to work the ops side, Afghan Task Force, Central American Task Force. Then I did the work as an analyst. Then I moved down to state CT. And in the state CT role, I was doing liaison with the FBI on the terrorism rewards program, continuing to work with DOD on overseas responses to terrorist incidents, working with FAA on aviation security, with the Maritime Administration on maritime security. So I was getting this whole picture of all the different moving parts. And so you would know when something was off that to the average American would appear normal. And let me give you, we'll give you a current example. Hey, the FBI is investigating the Charlie Kirk murder. Why?
Why? It's not a federal crime.
Yeah, it's not a federal crime. Now, if Charlie Kirk was black and you had some guy who was white, maybe you could make his argument as a hate crime civil rights case. But we saw the same thing with Seth Rich. It was even worse in the Seth Rich case, because the story was, here's this DNC staffer who's robbed in the middle of the night, killed or shot, and then dies, and the FBI is involved. And not just the FBI. Well, we later uncovered emails from the Washington field office to Peter Strzok, who was in charge of counterintelligence. Now, why in the world would FBI counterintelligence, which deals with foreign spies, be involved with the what was allegedly, ostensibly, a metropolitan Washington robbery?
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make sense. So, you know, I see those things and immediately, you know, the antenna go up. But the average American goes, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That's because they've seen Dragnet and, you know,
right.
The FBI should investigate everything. They don't understand how these different agencies interact and what their boundaries are and what they are not. And like in the case of Charlie Kirk, to try to pretend, oh, yeah, this one Utah kid, he was the lone shooter. And that's why we're involved as the FBI. Cut me a break.
Larry, when I was a junior analyst, I participated in an analytic roundtable inside the CIA. And there was an old man there, at least to my 28-year-old mind, he was an old man. He ended up being the National Intelligence Officer for Warning. And at the start of the meeting, people went around the table and congratulated him. And I whispered to the person I was sitting next to, why is everybody congratulating him? Oh, he got an age waiver from the director of the CIA. It turns out he had been in that job for 42 years. Now we're talking about six different presidents. He watched six different presidents come and go, and through six presidents, he was the National Intelligence Officer for Warning, deciding what long-term threats the president should hear about or should not hear about. Are there other examples out there that you think best illustrate what you would consider to be a deep state at work?
Yeah, you call it the best of the desperate. You know, the ones, you know, as you know, there's a large number of people that only do a brief time at CIA,
yes.
You know, four years, 6 years. And given the amount of money spent to train them, it's really very wasteful. But then there are those who stick around. And just by sticking around that long, you come to acquire knowledge. And that knowledge is, you know, it's nothing that you can go read in a book. You've been able to sort of, you've lived inside the matrix, and now you know how the matrix works. The other, I guess I would add to that, though, the other element was not so much longevity, but lack of accountability.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just talking earlier today with Danny Davis, and, you know, it was the same kind of thing. If you screw up, and as long as you're going with the program, you're going to get promoted.
Right.
You know, and if the program blows up, you always find some other reason to explain why it's a mess. And then also the whole level of the relationships, you know, as like in your case, you know, the animosity directed at you by John Brennan really had dramatic consequences for your life.
Yes.
And similarly, the friction with Tenet, because, you know, he felt like he was from the wrong side of the Greek island. And you know, you think that shouldn't interfere with policy making decisions, but it does. And that's the one thing I think people fail to grasp.
Well, and you've just said something, too. You almost kind of glossed over it, but I think it's important, and that is people's ability to fail upward. When they're terrible at their jobs, they tend to get promoted just so that they can be pushed out. So how much of what people attribute to the deep state do you think is that failing upward, or is the result of just career civil servants, intelligence agencies, maybe even the military pursuing their own institutional interests?
No, I think it's genuinely failing upwards. One of my career trainee classmates, he was a logs officer, logistics officer, but he was an Army Special Forces major when he joined the agency. Still, he'd been plied of part of what was called Blue Light, which was a competitor of Delta Force in the early days, back in the late 70s. So I mean, we're not talking some some, you know, pocket protector nerd. This guy was, he was on the ground operationally in Afghanistan in 9/11, like by December. He was the logs guy that was sent over. But he always said, you know, the CIA would be better off if they just had a bus drive randomly through Northern Virginia, D.C., and Maryland in Montgomery County and just pick up people randomly. They'd have a better selection of people.
Yes, I used to hear exactly the same thing. Exactly, you know, the same thing.
And so it was like, you know, in my class, there was a CIA legacy kid, Steve Hall. Did you ever hear that name?
No, don't know.
He was one of the 51 signatories to the letter saying, oh, that laptop computer from Hunter Biden could be Russian disinformation. And he'd served as Russian COS in Moscow, chief of station in Moscow. Well, his dad, you know, had been an agency guy, and there were a lot of, you know, his reputation was terrible. But, you know, well, the point was, some of these people got in not because they were, you know, met all the,
right,
you know, were the top of their class. They just had the right family, friends, connections. That was particularly the case on the admin side of the house. So you can't underestimate how interpersonal relations, and, you know, played an important role in shaping what the agency was. And the same, you know, same applies over at DOD. You've got to, you know, we like to pretend that these foreign countries are all corrupt. You know, oh, they're just, you know, they're playing to their family and friends. Well, hello.
That's right.
We do it too.
I even once worked with a guy whose mother, father, brother, and sister were all in the CIA. All five members of the family were all CIA officers. I remember thinking it was so incredibly strange, I couldn't even process it.
Yeah, yeah. So it's out of that that you get this a formed way of doing things, and are very reluctant to initiate change. But more importantly, the political types who come in, they usually don't have the background or knowledge. I mean, no. I'll give you a case in point with Devin Nunes. I think Devin's a great guy. I like Devin. Back in 2012, my next door neighbor, who is he's the largest defense lobbyist in town, lived next door to me in Bethesda. And he came to me in 2012, hey, I got this, a member of Congress, he's just been named to the House Intelligence Committee, would you mind briefing him? And I said, well, sure. And so I went down, I took a buddy of mine he'd been the admin chief for the NOC program. And we went down and met with Devin and basically tried to explain to him in 2.5 hours how the CIA worked, how sort of the intelligence community worked, what some of the issues were. I mean, that was the extent of his knowledge.
Right.
And then after that, he gets, you know, the meetings and the briefings with people, but he doesn't actually see the internal workings.
That's right.
And so it was in March of 2017 when the initial report came out that Donald Trump said, oh, the FBI was spying on me. Well, I knew from another source inside that this had been a coordinated intelligence operation between FBI, CIA, and it actually started with Brennan in the summer of 2015. So I texted Devin and said, hey, I need to come see you. And so I walked in and I said, you realize how they're spying on Trump and his team? And he said, no. I said, it's the Brits. The Brits are able to do it because they're not prohibited from spying on Americans. And then sitting right next to the GCHQ guy is an NSA analyst. And hey, right, it's liaison report. It's just liaison reporting. It's not illegal for CIA to receive that or NSA.
Right.
Because it's from foreign intelligence. You know, you're supposed to black out the names, et cetera. And so Devin, he didn't have a clue. Well, you know, he'd been 5 years in now. He was like chairman of the committee.
That's right.
And he didn't understand that. And this, I'm not criticizing him on that. I'm just pointing out that these people that are supposed to oversee this activity don't understand the scale and scope of it unless they've been on the inside.
That's right. It really is a deep state. Larry, hold that thought. We're going to take a short break. And when we return, we're going to talk about some of the specifics of fallout around the existence of the deep state. And is it dangerous to talk about the deep state too much? People ask me that a lot. Does it actually weaken democratic institutions? Stay tuned. Welcome back to The Whistleblowers. I'm John Kiriakou. We're joined today by former CIA analyst and counterterrorism official Larry Johnson, and we're talking about the deep state. Larry, thanks again for being with us.
Yeah.
The past 10 years or so have seen a huge increase in the number of deep state whistleblowers, especially in the US and the UK. How do you think such whistleblower revelations, leaks, controversial investigations have shaped public perceptions of the deep state, for better or for worse? What impact have they had?
I think they've actually had negligible impact because you know, if you look at the record of the whistleblowers, the government doesn't line up to give you a pat on the rear end and a pat on the back and go, "Atta boy, man, thank you for making us aware of this." I saw two manifestations of that now 25 years ago. The first was with Ambassador, the late Ambassador Joe Wilson, who ironically was married to my CIA career trainee classmate, Valerie Plame. I didn't know that at the time. But I was at a session at the Nixon Center hosted by Dimitri Symes, and Joe Wilson was there, Jim Schlesinger, former CIA director, W. Patrick Lang, former chief of the Middle East Division of DIA, you know, myself. I don't know how I wrangled an invitation, but there I was. And I remember Joe Wilson saying, you know, we've got to get to the president. He doesn't know. He's being lied to. I mean, Joe was not naive in many areas, but he actually was very naive to believe that that the president didn't know what was going on, and it was, Joe was going to be the one to bring the light. I heard the same thing from Gary Bernson. Mm-hmm. Gary was the leader of the Jawbreaker 2, the second CIA team into Afghanistan. I think it was the end of October. He replaced an older Gary. And again, when he came back from that and was writing his book, he goes, "Oh, I got to tell the president. He doesn't realize, you know." Both guys assumed that I've got the truth and I've got to get it to the president, sort of a whistleblower. Right. And the White House was not interested in what they had to say because they had their agenda. They knew what they were doing and they were pursuing it. It didn't matter what the facts were. I had a brief stint of it with respect to the nomination of Bob Gates, where, you know, I remember sitting once with an analyst from the who had the South African analyst guy at the time. Well, his name was John. We'll just leave it at that. And it wasn't you.
Right.
And he'd been asked by Gates. Said, the White House wants to know, is Nelson Mandela a communist? And John wrote up his analysis, and the bottom line was, Nelson Mandela is not a communist. And Bob Gates took his report and only changed one word. Can you guess what word that was?
I can guess. He took out the word not.
Not, exactly. Knew what the White House wanted, and by God, you're going to cook the intelligence to serve the president. Now, to John's credit, boy, he pitched a fit, and he raised the stink, and he forced Gates to back down. But that was an example of how someone like Bob Gates did not have the honor and integrity to go with the truth. He was going to shape and shade to please the White House. And again, this is an example where if you're the president and you actually genuinely want to know the ground truth, but you find out that your intelligence officers are shading it and fixing it so it says what they think you want to hear, you got a problem. And all I've seen that's happened over the last 20 years is that problem's gotten worse at CIA. In fact, we saw an example of that earlier this year in March when, so you know what it's like when you write the PDB and someone, one of the other agencies files a dissent.
Yes.
For your listeners.
The President's Daily Brief is what we're talking
yeah.
about. Yep.
So the Presidential Daily Brief, normally, usually the CIA analyst would have the lead on it. You know, I wrote for the PDB probably twice a week on average over a 2-year period. I had a lot of activity. And whenever I'd write a piece, I'd have to turn around and coordinate it with the analyst at the Bureau of Intelligence and Research, the State Department, and with the analyst, my counterpart at the Defense Intelligence Agency, and with a counterpart at the National Security Agency.
Right.
And we'd have to agree. We'd have to get consensus among all the four of us I couldn't just put out what I wanted. And there were times, very, very rare, mm-hmm. where there would be a disagreement.
Yes.
Well, earlier this year, the CIA put out in its PDB the statement that Russia was willing to agree to a ceasefire, that they didn't care about keeping the Nets, Donbass, that they would fold on those issues. And the state INR analysts, to their credit, said, that's not right. Listen to what Putin said. Listen to what Lavrov said. Listen to Rybkov. So went down the list. And they filed a dissent. Well, what happened out of that, we've subsequently learned, is that the Trump White House, Trump in particular, got mad at the dissenters. And they ended up getting fired.
Oh.
So, and then you wonder why Trump keeps saying things about Ukraine that are just flatly not true. And it's not it is partly his fault, because he's not encouraging, hey, I want to know the bottom line. I want to know the truth. Instead, you got to conform to what our narrative is. And so the failure of the intelligence community to not push back on that narrative is a problem. And then, back in my day, I was there even before you, there was a separation where the intelligence analysis was on one side of the house, operations on the other. But under our favorite director, Brennan, and that's sarcasm, they brought a lot of those together. And the problem that presents is when the operations, when they've got a covert action underway, they've got certain priorities and goals to meet. And if you as an analyst are saying anything that's perceived as undermining that, you're going to be attacked, you're going to be cut out. And so what it creates is an incentive for you, the analyst, to conform to what the director of operations is doing. Mm-hmm. And that means you're going to get inadequate, skewed intelligence.
Larry, to what extent do you think politics plays a role in the deep state? Do you think that the deep state is aligned with one particular ideology or party versus simply being focused on preserving its own power?
Yeah, no, I naively believed that there was a difference between Republicans and Democrats. I'll admit that now. In my younger days, I really believed that. Now I know it's garbage. Now I know it's just, it's a game. It's about making money and the financial incentives. And I think you pointed this out actually in one of your recent appearances on another podcast, that where the number of millionaires in Silicon Valley have now been replaced by the number of millionaires in Northern Virginia and
Maryland.
That's
right. That's exactly right.
And I recall I first moved to the D.C. area in 1979, and I lived in initially Chevy Chase, Maryland, then Bethesda. And I recall back then, 79, we didn't have Lamborghini, Rolls-Royce, Bentley. We didn't have these upscale, very expensive car dealerships.
Right.
You do now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they're all over the place.
And what do they actually produce in Washington, D.C.? Well, there's no factories. It's all government. It's all information influence peddling. And so that kind of institutionalized wealth ends up, it's embedded. It's got to protect that structure.
Right.
And we can't have anything that threatens that. In Trump's first term, I think one of the reasons they tried to take him out is they thought, they believed he was serious about ending NATO and U.S. involvement in NATO, getting us out. But listen, that's a jobs program for white guys, and it's a big money maker for some contractors.
Yes, it is.
We can't have that.
No, a lot of Americans have gotten rich because of NATO.
Yeah, and the other thing is, why don't we want to have? Why we must continually portray Russia as an enemy?
Exactly.
Well, by God, if we put Russia in NATO, how do you justify $1 trillion defense budget? And it was Yeltsin. Yeltsin made the request to George H.W. Bush. Putin made the request of Clinton, and the request with George W. Bush to join, rebuffed all across the board. And actually, I think Clinton and W. were initially inclined, oh, yeah, that sounds reasonable. But man,
right.
When they got to their advisors, they got straightened out real quick. You're not doing that.
Yeah, it was
that's the deep state.
Terrible missed opportunity. And you're right, that is the deep state. Larry Johnson, thank you very much for joining us. It's always good to see you, and we appreciate your insights. Thanks for being here.
Well, Brother Kiriakou, I appreciate your courage. Okay,
thank you, sir.
I learned how to pronounce your damn name.
But... after all these years. Well, the danger of the so-called deep state is not that it openly seizes power, but that it quietly inherits power. When anonymous officials, unaccountable agencies, and opaque networks can outlast elections and outmaneuver laws, the ballot box becomes theater instead of authority. A republic cannot survive if the people do not know who truly governs, or if those who govern never have to ask the people's permission. Thanks for joining us, and please subscribe to my Substack at John Kiriakou. Stay informed, and as always, keep asking the hard questions. I'm John Kiriakou, and thanks for watching The Whistleblowers.